this operation, running away, trying to save their life, leaving family members behind. They didn't know until today, not everybody's sure who was killed and who was not. People are still looking for their relatives. And then his family is watching YouTube and seeing their son being killed by a sniper in Sajaiya. And this is how they found out he's dead.
Well, we will leave it there. And for our listeners, we are showing the video on television, the horror that his parents discovered afterwards, his family. Eran Efrati, want to thank you for being with us. Former Israeli combat soldier turned anti-occupation activist, investigative researcher, recently interviewed a number of Israeli soldiers who participated in the Sajaiya massacre in Gaza. Later this month, Eran Efrati will testify at the Russell Tribunal in Palestine in Brussels. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, Friday, September 19th through the 21st at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. The goals of this Cascade Media Convergence are to create a space for media makers to network and share best practices, collectively learn skills, and lay the framework for continued collaboration and plant the seeds toward building a regional grassroots media coalition. There will be workshops, strategy sessions, and space and time for deeper discussions on all aspects of grassroots media. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, September 19th through 21st, at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come one, come all to the KBOO Community Radio Book and Record Sale, Sunday, September 14th. From 9 a.m., when the KBOO members only are allowed during the first hour of the sale, and then from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m., everyone can take advantage of truly interesting and unusual books, records, CDs, tapes, videos, DVDs, whatever else has been donated. The sale will take place this year at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder in Portland. Remember, all sales benefit your community radio station. For more information about the annual book and record sale, look at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. And don't forget to tune in to KBOO Friday night at midnight for the Broken Record Show, an offbeat sound patchwork composed entirely from items for the sale and served up by various KBOO disc jockeys and voices. That's the Broken Record Show, Friday night, September 12th from midnight till 3 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon State Legislature establishes racial impact statements for new bills.
Scotland heads towards independence.
And more news on labeling products with genetically modified organisms.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 12th, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Hundreds of students from Lewis and Clark College in Southwest Portland gathered last night for a community conversation, Beyond Ferguson. The presentations included professors, students, and community members, and focused on police violence in Missouri and beyond, including here in Portland. Lakeitha Elliott, a lifelong resident of Northeast Portland, is one of those who spoke at the event.
I'm here as a mom of a teenage daughter who, again, had the opportunity to participate in the ride to Ferguson from Portland. I'm also here as the sister of a brother who's a black man who suffers from mental illness and who, when my mom's had to call for help, when the police show up, the first thing she says is, please don't kill my son. And they often have said, well, we can't promise you anything, ma'am, but we'll do the best that we can. I'm also here of the cousin of five little kids who from two separate incidents don't have dads because their dads were killed by the Portland police. And so for me, I bring my daughter and my cousins and my brother and my mom here into this space to think about how these incidents impact everyone in our community. So like I said, my daughter is 17, and when we first saw that there was an opportunity to go to Ferguson, well, before that, when the incident first came, I noticed my daughter started posting things on Facebook, and she was really emotional about what was going on. And then she shared with me that she had had an argument with a friend who, when she mentioned Mike Brown, didn't know what she was talking about, and she was angry because she had this friend who's 17 who hadn't been paying attention to what was going on. And so I recognized that she was, you know, as safe as she feels in her community, she's part of a strong, safe community and family. She was dealing with the emotional impact of seeing this on the news and hearing about this. And so when there was an opportunity to go on the ride to Ferguson, I asked her, was she interested in going? And she said, yes. And so the two of us planned to go, and then there was something that came up and I wasn't able to go. And she said, I still want to go, Mom. I still, you know, that was that important to her that she had that opportunity to experience being in that space and going with the group of organizers. And part of what she shared there was one of the things that she shared was just that at one point she said it was a bunch of adults talking again and not listening. And so I think that's a lot of what I want to talk about too, is how are we engaging the people who are most impacted by this? One of the things that stood out to me in that video was that, and I happened to show up at both of those events. The first time I showed up, a group of Black folks stepped to the side, about four of us stepped to the side, and we were talking, we were having a side conversation, and a white person said to us, come on, we're doing this for you. And the response was just like, you're doing this for me, or are you doing this for all of us? And there's a quote that I often look at, and it says, if you've come to help me, you're wasting your time. If you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And so I think that's what I want, again, to bring to this space, is to ask, why are you here and why are you doing this? And if it's because, if it's for us or for my kid, or, and it's not for all of us, then you're probably doing it for the wrong reason. And if you're not including the people who are most impacted, then you are, you're wasting your time because you're not going to make a difference. I went to the second event that was at the park, and I just showed up to see what was going on. And when I stepped up, and it was like, okay, we're gonna go shut down the bridge and that kind of thing. And then later on, I saw a Facebook post from someone who was involved in that, and it said, well, why weren't more Black people showing up? They don't care, they're not doing this. And again, that was like a punch in the stomach. And what I shared is that every day we're marching, every day we're fighting to make sure that our kids get a high quality education. We're trying to protect them from getting shot by the police. And your march to go shut down a bridge isn't necessarily my first priority. And so again, we have to think of ways that we're engaging. Now, if the march had been planned by someone from the community and that was where we decided we were going to go, that would have been different and you could have supported. And I'm not saying that that march wasn't impactful. That's what that group needed and they could do, then they need to have it, but not on the expectation that it was for us, but it was for everyone and because you care about that issue. I'd like to challenge people to think about how you can leverage your white privilege to benefit all of us. Again, there are opportunities and ways that you can engage. One thing I appreciated, I think it was Ben said, is that he stepped up and connected to Ressa and said, how can I help? He didn't come in with any prescribed solutions about what he think we needed to do or how we needed to do it, but he came and said, how can I help? And that's the kind of humble people that we need to show up for this movement. And again, if it's shutting down a bridge and that's what you all need to do, that, you know, that's okay too. But to realize that sometimes your privilege will allow you to do that where it's not as safe for me. And so to think about those things when you're thinking about organizing around issues that impact specific communities.
That was Lakeitha Elliott speaking last night at a community conversation beyond Ferguson at Lewis and Clark College in Southwest Portland.
An article in this week's Portland Mercury brings up the question of who is keeping track of police shootings nationwide and comes up with the disturbing answer that no one is. So members of the Mental Health Association of Portland joined forces with a group of Wikipedia editors to create a comprehensive list of police killings across the country for the month of August. They found that over 100 people were killed by law enforcement officers in the month of August. In no instance during this single month were charges filed in any on-duty killings. All deaths were deemed justifiable prior to the investigation. No mayor apologized to grieving parents, spouses, or children. For a few deaths, people marched in the streets, and for others, not even a name was announced. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland about the study.
In your research, what did you find out when you looked into who is keeping track of the national statistics of police shootings?
Well, there isn't an overall body that supervises or monitors police activities in the United States. The FBI keeps track of about 700 judiciaries, but there are almost 17,000 in the United States, so there's a lot of not monitoring going on.
So there isn't a national database of homicides by police?
Not that we know of, no. Not that we're able to find it.
And what did you find out in doing the research for the month of August 2014?
Well, I found that 104 persons had been killed by U.S. law enforcement in the month of August, and that includes law enforcement officers and their friends and family members.
And how does that compare to FBI estimates?
Well, the FBI estimated that there were 400 deaths per year. So if you calculate out 104, if August is an average month, and we don't know if it is, our number would be much higher than the FBI's number.
And what were some of the examples of the police shootings that you identified during the month of August outside of the well-known shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, there were many shootings, both well-known in the media, such as Michelle Cousseau in Phoenix, and completely obscure deaths, including several people who the police and the local media declined to identify. So 104 is a wide spectrum of people. The most interesting statistic we're able to call from this, and this is a very crude methodology, obviously, is that about 61% of the persons killed by law enforcement are people of color.
And here in Portland, we have a settlement now with the Department of Justice and the Portland Police on the issue of undue use of force against people with mental illness. Do you think that settlement is going to change the pattern of abuses that have been indicated in the past?
No, we don't. We think that that settlement is not a reasonable or fair settlement, and we had hoped that the judge would bring the parties to trial or bring the parties back to renegotiate that settlement. But the city is motoring on, and they're going to hire someone to monitor the settlement now. And we also believe that that process has been bungled by City Hall.
Now, you differ in this from the Albino Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Accountability, who have signed on to this settlement. So are you saying the Portland Mental Health Association doesn't agree that this is the way to go?
Well, we are members of the Albino Ministerial Alliance, and we're very appreciative of the wisdom of the leadership there. We take their advice very seriously, but in this particular case, we wish that the city had done made a greater effort to find a better selection of possible court monitors. So we disagree with the AMA coalition on this point.
And are you calling for further action, either from local or national government agencies, on this?
Well, we're a very small voice in a very big pond. I think there's a lot of criminal justice advocates and mental health advocates for people of color who are calling for higher level of accountability for police officers. We're really fortunate here in Portland that we have such great people looking at these cases so closely. We're way ahead of the rest of the nation. It's so sad to see other big cities like Seattle or New York or San Francisco having almost no activity at all, and we would call on those communities to get started.
Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland. And again, if you want to find more information about that list on Wikipedia, you can look up list of killings by law enforcement officers in the United States. You can also find his article on this week's Portland Mercury. It's called Someone Has to Do It. No one's been reliably tracking police shootings. Here's a start. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Last year, the Oregon State Legislature passed a bill on proposed legislation allowing for legislators to ask for racial impact statements. These reports aim to avoid unintended consequences affecting communities of color and to provide greater accountability for lawmakers. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Helen Silvis from the Scanner newspaper.
The reason why we're talking today is because the Oregon State Legislature in July of 2013 passed a law that will give lawmakers an option to request a racial impact statement before the legislature votes on certain issues. Can you tell me exactly what a racial impact statement is?
My understanding is that Craig Prince, who's one of the staffer at the Criminal Justice Commission, will take a look at how a particular law or policy is likely to impact different communities. They will try and predict in advance how many people will be affected and how they will be affected and whether there are disproportionate impacts on any particular community of people.
Once an issue comes up, how does the process work in terms of them requesting this information?
It will take two legislators to ask for a racial impact statement to start that process and make it happen. And they have to be from different parties. So there'd be one Democrat and one Republican would have to request a racial impact statement on a proposed piece of legislation. Where members of the public can get involved in the process is that they can be watching for legislation that they believe might have a disparate impact, and they can ask their legislator to work on it with another legislator.
Why is this law necessary? Why has it been passed?
There have been several laws that have come into being that have had unintended consequences that weren't really foreseen by the people who made the decision to pass the law. We recently reported on Seattle's ordinance against using marijuana in public. And what happened with that ordinance was it was created to because the lawmakers thought, well, we can't have people just smoking around anybody and children and in public and so on. So they wanted to make that a misdemeanor, and they were ticketing people from it. But then a year later, when they came to look at how it had impacted the Seattle communities, it resulted in homeless people receiving 41% of the tickets and African Americans 37%. Well, if you've been to Seattle, you probably know that only around 8% of Seattle residents are black, but they are being disproportionately punished by that particular law. So there's an instance where a racial impact statement, it could have perhaps predicted that it would have a disparate effect on black communities. And that doesn't mean that the lawmakers won't pass the bill. They may very well go ahead and pass those bills. They may believe that the good outweighs the bad in it, but at least if there is a racial impact statement, they'll have an opportunity to consider whether maybe there'll be unintended consequences that will damage communities of color.
People have different definitions of what the term race means. Our U.S. Census doesn't include Hispanic or Latino as a race, and a lot of government documents feel that way as well. Which communities of color will this apply to?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I know the exact answer to that. I am sure that the intention of the bill is to look at all of Oregon's communities and not leave any of them out. But in practice, I don't know whether the way it's been crafted will achieve that.
The two issues in particular that I'll focus on is criminal justice or child welfare. Are those the only two, or can it be?
Yes,
any, or
those are the two. And the reason for that is that historically there has been severely disproportionate numbers of African American and also other people of color, Latinos, who get involved in the correction system. And very often it's a situation where we know that white people are committing the crime as often as blacks, but that blacks are being arrested and charged and convicted at much higher rates. So we know, for example, that for drug offenses, blacks are actually less likely to use some drugs than whites, but they're more likely to go to jail for using them. So that's the history of it, and it's the same with the child welfare system. We know that disproportionate numbers of children of color end up in foster care, and we know that there is there's disproportionality at every level of the system. And this is a historical fact that this racial impact statement legislation was sort of set up to remedy. I think that was one of the major reasons behind it.
Do you have anything else that you want to contribute in any way?
Well, I should say that there is a forum from noon to 1 p.m. on Tuesday, September 16th in Salem in the Hearing Room 50 at the Oregon State Capitol to explain exactly how community members can take part in that process.
I have been speaking with Helen Silvis from The Scanner. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
U.S. Senate candidate for Oregon, Monica Webby, has a TV ad that may surprise you. The man in the ad, Ben West, is a Portland resident and happens to be one half of the couple that sued to overturn Oregon's ban on same-sex marriage, which was struck down in May of this year. The ad first shows Ben West and his husband, Paul Rummel, getting married with former Portland Mayor Sam Adams officiating the ceremony. West continues to speak about standing up for equality and the unemployed. While Hummel remains a lifelong Democrat, West, who identifies as a Republican, called Webby's campaign office to volunteer. After sitting down with the couple and talking about marriage equality, Webby convinced them to appear in the TV ad. Webby claims that she has been painted as an extreme right-wing Republican. According to a phone interview with Politico, Webby made the ad to show voters that she supports marriage equality, abortion rights, and is not just another cookie-cutter conservative. While supporting gay rights is not unusual for Republicans, this is the first time a Republican ad for a national office featured a same-sex couple.
Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley today announced his support for President Obama's bombing campaign against the right-wing militia group ISIS. Merkley gave his support to the bombing campaign after receiving a classified briefing along with other Senate Democrats yesterday. On September 1st, when the first U.S. airstrikes were launched against ISIS, Merkley had said he was extremely skeptical of U.S. military actions in Iraq and Syria. But now the senator has done an about-face and has lined up with other Democrats behind President Obama in his bombing campaign. In his statement, Senator Merkley said that based on what he heard from President Obama and top military and intelligence leaders, the administration's plans appear consistent with a limited American role. He said that the U.S. bombing needs to be limited in scope and time, with opportunities at regular intervals to evaluate the success of the efforts. Merkley's Republican opponent, Monica Webby, on Thursday criticized President Obama for pulling troops out of Iraq and said that he should have bombed ISIS sooner. The only candidate for Jeff Merkley's seat in the U.S. Senate who opposes U.S. bombing in Iraq and Syria is the Green Party candidate, Christina Lugo.
The Multnomah County Commission Board voted on Thursday to invest $1 million in helping minority youth get jobs, stay in school, and out of jail. The money will go to the United Way of the Columbia Willamette, who will divide it up between agencies participating in its Breaking the Cycle program. the one launched last year to address childhood poverty. Loretta Smith, the Multnomah County Commissioner, said the money will go to 400 youth in lower socioeconomic classes. Smith promised to lobby for more money in the program next year, saying that the investment was not just a one-time deal for her. The program could get permanent funding if it proves successful at addressing disparities of low-income minority youth and their families. Keith Tomajan, executive director of the United Way of the Columbia Willamette, said the agency will provide reporting and evaluation to track the money's impact. The United Way will also report on a regular basis with a team from Human Services, the County Department of Community Justice, and the Office of Diversity and Equality.
The city of Springfield, Oregon, is facing a lawsuit from a former fire department employee who alleges that she was discriminated against because of her age. Linda Morris was 64 when she says city officials forced her to accept a retirement package. She said that she was accused of forging a signature on a document, but when she challenged the accusation and demanded a hearing, her manager refused. Instead, she said she was forced to accept a retirement package when she had no intention of retiring. The city said they will not comment on the lawsuit, which seeks $1.2 million in damages.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has awarded a grant of $6.5 million to health centers around Oregon State. The purpose of the funding is to expand primary care services at 29 different locations. The award will allow the health centers to hire about 95 new staff members and extend their hours. Also aims to add more services, including oral health, mental and behavioral health, pharmacy, and vision. The Affordable Care Act funding will help the centers to reach an estimated 25,500 new patients in Oregon. Across the country, $295 million was awarded to almost 1,200 health centers.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 88. Sunday we'll see even warmer temperatures with a high of 91. On this day in 1959, the TV show Bonanza became the first regularly scheduled program to broadcast in color. And on September 12, 1992, Mae Jemison became the first African-American woman in outer space as the Space Shuttle Endeavour launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The quote of the day comes from author David Foster Wallace, who died 6 years ago today. He said, "Everybody is identical in their secret, unspoken belief that way deep down they're different from everyone else."
It is now 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Boss, spelled backwards, is double S-O-B, and that's how most of the employees of the U.S. Postal Service feel about their top boss. America's postal employees, from mail clerks to letter carriers, take great pride in moving millions of pieces of mail to us every day, whether we live in inner cities or way down at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, where mail is delivered by mule-riding letter carriers to a Native American tribe living there. But USPS bossman Postmaster General Pat Donahoe definitely does not make postal workers proud, for he's been deliberately monkey-wrenching our mail system by slowing delivery, reducing staff and hours of service, closing neighborhood and historic post offices, shutting processing centers, trying to end Saturday delivery, bad-mouthing his own agency's performance, steadily corporatizing public functions, and transforming decent, union-scale jobs into the low-wage retail economy. One portentous example of Donahoe's determination to bust the wages and undermine the performance of USPS is the sweetheart privatization scam he's set up with Staples. He's letting the big box retailer place official postal kiosks in his 1,500 stores. Only, they're not being staffed by highly trained, publicly accountable postal workers, but by Staples' own poverty wage, high turnover floor staff. In at least one case, Donahoe even cut the hours of service at post offices around a Staples store, then put up a sign directing postal customers to the Staples outlet. Mark Demenstein, the feisty president of the American Postal Workers Union, calls Donahoe Wall Street's Trojan horse, the privatizer from within. But, says Demenstein, we intend to stop him. His union has launched a Dump Donahoe campaign as well as a national boycott of Staples stores. For information, go to apwu.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Oregon voters will soon decide whether to require that the genetically modified ingredients in food products be labeled in order to be sold here. Michael Hansen, a biologist who has weighed in on the debate nationally as senior scientist at Consumer Reports, is sharing his thoughts on Measure 92 in visits to four Oregon cities. For more, we go to KBOO's Lisa King in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Backers of Measure 92 are getting some help this week from one of the big names in the food labeling debate nationwide. Michael Hansen, senior scientist for Consumer Reports, is in Oregon making several stops to debunk some common myths. The big companies opposing the ballot measure claim that labeling GMO foods will cost a lot, but Hansen says that it isn't any more expensive for companies than other details now required on a food label.
You have to label milk whether it's been homogenized or not. You have to label juices whether they've been frozen or from concentrate or fresh squeezed. Fish you have to label whether they're wild-caught or farm-raised. We have country of origin labeling. Most importantly, look at irradiation labeling.
He says more than 60 countries